We are taught, of course, never to judge others. As the saying goes, there is so much good in the worst of us and so much bad in the best of us that it ill behoves any of us to talk about the rest of us. And also, we've been enjoined throughout our lives not to cast the first stone. But surely there comes a time, and it could be in these months and years, when casting a few stones and judging others is a necessity for Western civilization, such as it is, if nothing else. Bob Riley, a retired US Republican politician, said that tolerating evil leads only to more evil. And when good people stand by and do nothing while wickedness reigns, their communities will be consumed. The well-known US psychologist Philip Zimbardo says, bullies may be perpetrators of evil, but it is the evil of passivity of all those who know what is happening and never intervene that perpetuates such abuse. They both, of course, were following on from Edmund Burke, who, as we know, famously said that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. The background, indeed, to this talk is the seeming widespread public view that evil is triumphing, is trumping good, that there is more suffering and pain and that globally, besides cruel wars, which we don't need to go into, minorities are under monstrous pressure. Small ethnic and religious groups, the poor, immigrants, LGBT people, are being harassed and squeezed by religious fundamentalists, big tech business, powerful despotic government, and the far right. There is a gathering cruelty in the air. Caroline Mace tells us that evil is real. In her book, The Courage to Confront Evil, she says evil is a real continuous force, just like there is a conscious force of good. We think, she says, that we have abolished evil. Indeed, people are comfortable with the idea of angels, but not of demons. But there are demonic forces, and these are real, are messages of darkness. Mace says that while she has never been around a demon, she has a high sense of when she is near this darkness, of when she is near people whose only intent is to corrupt those around them, to diminish their self-worth, to take possession of them in some way. This, she says, is a form of evil. Richard Rohr, who many of us know, R-O-H-R, as part of his daily meditations, writes that we are still quite capable of full complicity in deeds of death. Governments, religions, and corporations are all highly capable of evil while not recognizing it as such, because it profits us for them to be immoral. If, he says, we don't see the shape of evil or recognize how we are fully complicit in it, it will control us while not looking the least like sin. The beginning of the way out from evil, he concludes, is to honestly see what we are doing. And the mature religion must, quotes, train us to recognize the many camouflages of evil. So, of course, it is vital before we try to tackle evil that we are clear about what it is, and that we remember, in regard to evil, pain and suffering and character, almost always, as Peter Vardy says in his book, The Puzzle of Evil, black is mixed with white, or at least grey. Vardy says that even Hitler, who did malevolently wicked things, had his good points, transforming a war-torn country after World War I. Franco, he writes, was vilified, but his officials saved more Jews in World War II than did the French government under Pétain. And he goes on to talk about Guy Fawkes and Oliver Cromwell, who, he says, while he brought democracy to England, was in many ways an ill-mannered murderer, which I think we know. Indeed, this issue of the complexity of seemingly wicked characters has arisen in our courts. Some years ago, a soldier was convicted of a heinous sex crime. Before sentence, an officer told the court that the defendant was a courteous, good soldier. This, I believe, was what he was obliged to do, so that the judge could have a rounded view of the defendant before him. The officer was outlining his experience of the soldier independently of the evidence given in court. But this didn't discourage condemnation of the officer, whose critics did not understand the nature of character evidence, or indeed one's maybe Christian or human duty to outline whatever goodness was in the guilty soldier. And many of us, of course, will be familiar with Hannah Arendt's report, The Banality of Evil, on the 1960s Israeli trial of Adolf Eichmann for genocide. Hannah Arendt was trying to analyze why a seemingly mild-mannered man could have perpetrated such monstrous crimes. She decided that the evil done was because ordinary men wanted to obey orders. Above all, they prized bureaucratic efficiency. What had become banal, she said, was the failure to think, the consequences of which could be genocide. The indictment of Eichmann went beyond the man to a world in which true thinking, she said, had vanished, as might be increasingly apparent today. The consequence was that crimes against humanity became thinkable. Like Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning, she also criticized the concept of collective guilt, where those personally innocent during the Nazi era admitted to collective guilt, while the real criminals showed no remorse. To Hannah Arendt's dismay, Eichmann said that he was acting from obedience, a precept he said he had taken from Immanuel Kant. For Arendt, this was outrageous, as Kant's moral philosophy was bound up with the man's faculty of judgment, which rules out blind obedience. For Kant, every man is a legislator the moment he starts to act, which I think is a very profound statement. Evil is complicated, therefore, as is pain and suffering, of which more later. And throughout the centuries, well before the Common Era, thinkers have sought to define what it is and how it arises. In one definition, for example, it is that which works against the welfare of humankind are the purpose of a benevolent God. In another, we are told that moral evil is due to the deliberate act of human beings who, with free will, choose to be less than God intended. For others, evil is the fault of demons let loose upon the world because of the hubris of man or the rebellion against God by disgruntled angels. And when we look back the centuries at what various cultures believed about evil, a perennial question was why an omniscient God and an omnipotent God and even omnidevelopment benevolent God would allow evil, both moral and natural, when he could prevent it. For the ancient Greeks, all things came from the gods, so they were the sources of evil as well as of good. The existence of evil, pain, and suffering was accepted simply as part of the inscrutable will of the god Zeus. And after the Golden Age, these evils only entered the world when they escaped from the famous box brought by the first woman, Pandora. Like that other woman, Eve, Pandora ended the Golden Age of mankind. In her case, when she disobeyed Zeus and out of curiosity opened the box, releasing all the evils and miseries of the world. As Albert Reynolds famously said, that's women for you. Or as Adam said, pointing at Eve, it was her that did it. For Aristotle, if there is good, there has to be evil. The absence of the good in any pair of contraries is always negative in relation to the other. Darkness is the absence of light, etc. Epicurus, who lived around till about 270 BCE, is credited with formulating a riddle. If God is willing to prevent evil, but not able, then he is not omnipotent. If he is able, but not willing to prevent evil, then he is malevolent. This was followed up later by the Scottish philosopher David Hume. For the believer, in the broadest sense, it is a question which continuously arises and which may never be resolved satisfactorily. While for many non-believers, it is further proof that such a being as God does not exist. Irenaeus accepted God's partial responsibility for evil. Human beings are imperfect creatures who must be made perfect by development and growth. Evil is a means to an end, and the world with its mingled good and evil is part of God's plan. Augustine followed this with amendments. For him, good is a substance which is ultimately most expressed in God. But evil is no substance. It is a perversion of the will, a turning aside from God. He distinguishes between moral evil and natural evil, his views on the latter causing problems for many thoughtful Christians. For him, moral evil is a privation or lack, while natural evil, like earthquakes, pain, illness, is an outworking of God's perfect creation, which could also be seen as a punishment for sin. Augustine rejected the idea that there are equal evil and good powers at work in the universe, saying that all substances are good, even the flames of hell, because they come from God. And God has no responsibility for the existence of moral evil. That is the fault of myself and yourself, who misuse the gift we have been given. Anything, according to Augustine, that departs from its being, that is not what it should be, is to that extent evil. Like the man who does not fulfill the nature that God had intended for him. Thomas Aquinas follows this view. While moral evil is due to the deliberate acts of those who have free will and are choosing to be less than intended, natural evil is part of God's creation, caused incidentally as part of nature. For instance, a disease that causes great pain. It is only from our perspective, not God's, that we see this as evil. And God, says Aquinas, has no moral obligations to the creatures that he creates. Such what might be termed callousness may offend many people, although there is a view that if God could prevent all pain and suffering, it would take away our freedom. Another belief called the Great Controversy that percolates to this day comes from the Seventh-day Adventists. Satan became discontented with God's laws, led a rebellion, and was expelled from heaven. The field of battle continues to this day. And then it shifted to the earth, where Satan infected Adam and Eve with the same pride. Zoroastrianism in ancient Persia had a somewhat similar view, envisaging the world as a scene of struggle between light and darkness. And so we come to Adam and Eve, the story of their creation and disobedience having had huge influence on Western thought. Women, according to Mary Condren, have been identified with Eve, the symptom of our negative nature, the depths to which we can sink if we are not faithful to our religious heritage, and woman can only attain sanctity by identifying with the Virgin Mary, who was conceived without sin. So, in one view, the world is a battle between good and evil, in some way limiting the omnipotence of God. Our God is a despot. What he wills is right because he is God. As expressed by the Swiss theologian Karl Barth, who refused to discuss the problem of evil. If God is God, he said, how can we dispute his wisdom in making things as they are? If God decrees that this man shall be saved and this one damned, this is just because he is God. But in contrast to the view that God is absolute and the other view that he is subject to limitations, there stands the mediating view that God's power is limited only by his own character of righteousness, truth, and love. This is a stance which might sit more easily with many Christians and God believers in Unitarianism, who might agree with some of the following. One, that in creating mankind, God desired to bring into existence beings who could freely choose the true, the beautiful, and the good. One that opposes the belief that God allows evil and suffering so human beings can be free to enter a two-way love relationship with him. One that does not accept natural evils, earthquakes, suffering, etc., as an inevitable byproduct of God's aim of developing souls and moral character. One that believes, like Ivan Karasimov in Dostoevsky's novel, that the suffering of innocent children can never be justified by some eventual end or purpose planned by God. One that takes on view the views of some Jewish theologians, that Christians do not take seriously enough the theology of suffering and demand that any theology should be capable of being undertaken in the presence of burning children. One that agrees that the church has harped too much on sin. As Leslie Weatherhead says, in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus used the noun only on 6 occasions and the verb on 3. St. Paul, however, seemed obsessed with sin, using the word 91 times. One that accepts that Leslie Weatherhead's criticism of the old Anglican baptism that said all men are conceived and born in sin. One that agrees with the optimistic view of Francis Hutcheson, father of the Scottish Enlightenment, born in County Down, who Fergus has discussed with us a number of times, that people are born with what might be called a clean slate. They are not motivated by self-interest or human gain. Or one that believes that there is evil in the world which must be confronted. Or that agrees with Caroline Mace that evil is manifesting itself more now because we have decided it does not exist and that gives it free rein. Or some that, like Richard Rohr, asks, how much are we complicit in the evil deeds of large corporations because it profits us for them to be immoral? And we could ask, what are we doing today, maybe only half realizing it, that facilitates evil? Charging what the market will bear for goods and services rather than a fair price. Ignoring tax avoidance by those who work for us. Jumping the medical queue because of our financial clout. And to the detriment of young couples seeking houses, lobbying against planning applications for spurious and selfish reasons. I've been guilty of at least one or two of those activities, some would say evils, which, as Caroline Mace puts it in the broader context, we have decided do not exist. She is right, I think, when she says our most important choice now is to get our conscience up and running as soon as we can. Amen.